Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station run almost entirely by volunteers and is here to give the community of Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Henleys, Glenys Morgan. And Polly Winch, political economist, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Foreign Secretary William Hague announces more sanctions against Iran. But even if they got a nuclear bomb, are they really crazy enough to use it? As broadcasting regulator Ofcom revokes Iranian Channel Press TV's UK licence, leaving a blank screen where they used to be, does Ofcom represent the public in any way? Joining us to discuss all this is Iranian-born Bristol resident Mehrnaz Shahabi. Southmead Hospital's PFI as North Bristol NHS Trust goes foundation status. We get the lowdown from French Chase Chief Executive Ruth Brunt. And Occupy Bristol, as the camp tats down, spokesperson Tony Cripps is here to explain whether Occupy Bristol is over and what, if anything, it's achieved. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs again 3 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, but cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs a little lower at 2 Celsius. Plenty of sunshine this week, but feeling cold. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of February, highs down to 1 Celsius. Snow, possibly, next weekend, and sunny spells. Incredible. At last, some snow, maybe. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Lib Dem councillor for Henleys, Glenys Morgan. Hi, Glenys. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
First of all, you've been a councillor for a couple of years now. What brought you into politics?
It was almost by accident, the politics part. I was a deliverer for the Lib Dems, foolishly went along to see what being a councillor involves, and a few persuasive words from one of our guys out there, and suddenly I was up in a seat where nobody else was standing, which I didn't know at the time.
But okay, so really, someone was twisting your arm, were they?
A little bit. We're always looking for new candidates, yeah.
Okay. What made you choose the Lib Dems to get involved with, deliver their newsletter rather than somebody else's? Because one of the things we constantly get on here is, well, actually all the main political parties are pretty much the same.
I've joined been with the Lib Dems really since SDP days, if you can remember back that far. You look a bit young for that to me.
Thank you. But yes, I can, yeah.
And I've joined SDP and then subsequently Liberal Democrats because I feel it's a party that is a bit more objective. It's not tied to big business. It's not tied to trade unions, looking for fairness and more equality within society, closing the gap.
But it certainly seems to be tied to big business at the moment in the coalition at Westminster, doesn't it?
I don't think that makes us tied to big business. That's... That, I think, was the right way to go for the country at that time, to try and bring some stability into the situation. And we would go into a coalition with Labour, Greens, Conservatives. At that time, it was the right thing to do with the Conservatives.
Okay.
It gives us an opportunity to do some of the things that we wanted to do, despite only having, I think, 57 MPs out of 364. So, as we like to say sometimes, we think we're, hitting a little bit above our weight.
Okay. Now, what about your background? What was your what's your sort of day job or whatever? Yeah. Do you still have one
just,
now?
No, which is quite a good thing because being a counsellor is really a full-time job. I was full-time at the university, University of Bristol, in admin. My last post was as a manager in one of the engineering departments. I've been there since 1990. Before that, I was at the University of Essex. And so that's my background. I've got four children.
But you've given that up now. And you're saying, really, that being a councillor is a full-time job. But we know many of our councillors do have other full-time jobs. In fact, they can be quite difficult to get hold of, can't they? Because they're busy working.
Yes. I think it's really very, very difficult. And I think they work all hours. But being on committees is one way of either doing more or less. There are a lot of committees to sit on, scrutiny committees, where you're looking at the different things that are going on around the city, challenging them. And I think it's good if those who aren't working full time can take on some of those, and those who are working full time then can try and balance the two things. But I think this is one reason why it's very difficult for younger people, and particularly young women, to get in. And it's really, it's quite a challenge to manage it all, especially, I think, with emails and Twitter and Facebook, all these media to try and keep on top of.
So have you given up your career then for politics?
Well,
that's
quite a sacrifice
to make, isn't it?
I've actually reached retirement age at least now. So I was 60 in December. So that sort of coincided quite well with, I had the option to take my pension from the university. So I can now devote the next few years properly until election comes by to the councillor work.
Okay. And what committees are you on then?
Health and adult social care, which is a really big one.
So you better bring us up to date. You better bring us up to date, particularly on what's happening with the social care, because John Rogers was on here before Christmas talking about it and saying that early in the new year there was going to be some announcements about what was happening, particularly to things like daycare and care of elderly people in old people's homes.
Yes. Well, trying to support people in being more independent, not using homes so much, focusing more on dementia, using the staff that are there more in that specialist area, because we know that's a growing area of concern. So there's so many big changes coming through from government that we're getting lots of briefings and lots of information to take in on that, and watching how it's all being going forward.
So what's going to happen? I mean, this is what everyone wants to know. What's the early indications of what's likely? Because, I mean, particularly elderly people who are in these care homes right now are biting their nails, as are their relatives. The last thing they need is uncertainty over their future. I mean, they're already frail towards the ends of their lives. The last thing they need is to be worrying about being taken out of that home in the next year or so.
Yeah, I haven't heard that there's any plans to take people out of homes in the next year or so. I'm sure anything that happens will be carefully phased, and it's more in those using the personalisation agenda to give people choices on where they want to be in future, and it's not necessarily the best place to be in a home where you're not near your family or friends.
Okay, well, we're also joined by political economist Polly Winch. Hi, Polly. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Now, a couple of things this week. First of all, borrowing has been announced has gone over $1 trillion. Now, apparently, George Osborne and the Conservatives have been dealing with the deficit, and yet the deficit seems to be going up. I don't quite understand. Can you just explain that for us?
Well, I think lots of people are at a loss as to why this is happening. I mean, the thing that strikes me really is, like you say, the government says it's dealing with the deficit, but borrowing is just going up and up and up. And it seems more, I read an interesting article by Gillian Tett in the Financial Times a few weeks ago, talking about how the numbers are getting bigger and bigger, and there's more and more zeros to the point where they're almost kind of meaningless, really. And I wonder whether, these figures are kind of used in order to sort of create public acquiescence for the cuts and, dealing with the issues leading to the issues that you were discussing, Glenys. So it's kind of like an ideological thing, really, rather than they are genuinely concerned about reducing a deficit.
So $1 trillion, what is $1 trillion? A million, million, is that right?
Yeah, loads of zeros.
Okay, so, but what about this whole business of, I mean, Mr. Osborne has promised us, and Mr. Cameron has promised us to be dealing, this is what they're going to do, they're dealing with the debt, they're paying it off, they can't leave this debt for future generations, and yet it's still going up. We also had last week an announcement of the first 3 months, or the last 3 months, unemployment is up 120,000, with nearly 50,000 of those being youngsters between 18 and 24. So, well, what's your analysis of all this? It doesn't sound to me as if he's actually managing to achieve what he says he's trying to achieve, Polly.
Yeah, and I think that's quite widely recognised, even perhaps by the government themselves, despite the rhetoric. I think they are aware that, and David Cameron was talking at Davos saying, how high unemployment was becoming. And I think, to be honest, it just seems like things are quite out of control within the government. And I'm not sure you know, like I've said before, whether they really have a handle on the situation.
Okay, so if you were in George Osborne's shoes, what would you be doing? Because I think this is one of the things that many of us are frustrated about, is it's all very well pointing the finger and saying, oh, you know, Osborne's not doing it right. But, I mean, what could he do, Polly, which would actually make a bit of a difference?
Well, I think for a start, one of the first things I'd do it would be to set up a truly independent inquiry into the nature and the causes of the financial crisis. I've talked about this before on the show. You know, I don't see that the National Audit Office, who are responsible for, you know, kind of investigating what the government does with public money, have actually conducted a proper investigation. They haven't looked at the balance sheets. They haven't looked at, you know, how whether the extra capital was truly necessary, what happened with the nationalisations of the banks. So I think step one would be to really investigate the causes of the financial crisis, because if that's going to be the main justification for these cuts, then there needs to be a proper investigation. And I think if that happened, then you might start to find that the cuts really aren't actually necessary at all, and they are ideological in nature.
Glynis, what's your thoughts about what Polly's saying here? I mean, the idea that the cuts are ideological means that there's actually something else going on here. It's not just a numbers game where they're saying, well, we just simply can't do this. We can't give Bristol from Westminster the money to, for example, look after people in social care. So what's your thoughts about what Polly's saying? There's another agenda here, really, that's where they could be dealing with the problems much better than they are at the moment.
Well, I find that really interesting to think that ideological. I think it's very good idea to really analyse what the problem was, because solving anything, you know, make sure you know what's caused it in the first place. So so I'd welcome that. And I think there's real problems out there, and that we see how other countries have really gone badly wrong. You know, Ireland, Greece, Italy, who would have thought Italy might be facing problems? So I think we can't wait too long to start doing something about it. You know, we've got to address it and start doing things now. So I think it is important for people to at least realise the problem, even if we haven't identified it properly yet.
Okay.
and be aware of doing something about it, yeah.
We've got this World Economic Forum going on this week, which is almost like something from a James Bond movie, with all the richest people in the world all getting together up in the Swiss Alps, you know, miles away, so, you know, they can have good security because they can see everywhere. Everything's white snow everywhere. Mm. And I mean, if you had the floor there, what would you be saying to these heads around Europe about, you know, get your finger out? What sort of thing would you be saying to them about how to sort out the problem? Because ultimately, there seems to be, we seem to be hearing solutions again and again, which are kind of putting off the solution to the financial crisis. And it does seem that we're in this kind of death spiral where the money's coming in is never going to pay this debt off. It's growing like Topsy, and we're never actually going to get to pay the debt off.
Yes, and isn't it said that you never actually do aspire to pay the whole debt off? You just get it to a manageable level.
Well, that's nice for the banks, isn't it? Because they're constantly taking their interest. But, I mean, practically, the debt is growing faster than you can actually bring in taxes to pay it off, then we're on a road to nowhere, aren't we?
Well, I'm really not an economist, but all I can say is that if people do need to take a firm line where they need to, not be... I don't like to see people lobbying who just have the strongest arm to do that. Work together and recognise, I think that would be to everybody's benefit. Choose some good people, economists, to take your advice from.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, of course, that we, as shareholders in places like Royal Bank of Scotland, we control these banks, and yet we've just heard this week £1 million bonus to the boss. I mean, is that justified?
Well, as you could look at it and say it's only, a tenth of what the Barclays boss got. But I do not like these huge bonuses. I think we've got to get away from the culture that's there. We're constantly told that, that's not bad, but if we don't do something, they're just going to leave, you know, and all their board with them. Well, let's not have people on the board who... I can't believe that all these people are not irreplaceable. Nobody's irreplaceable. And I would like to call their bluff at times. But I think we can't do anything drastic just like that. We have to do it stepwise. But we really do want to change the culture. And I would like to see employees getting much more of a say in that. And as regards the whole economy, also I did mean to say that really invest on things like green energy and all the renewable things that will really benefit us in the future, and things we know we've got to do something about. So let's create jobs there.
Okay, Polly, before I ask you what you would be saying in Davos, I'm putting you on the spot. You're George Osborne in 1 minute and then you're James Cameron the next. But before we do that, let's hear from David Cameron at Davos in Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, this year's big confab of all the richest and most powerful people in the Western world.
There are a number of features that are common to all successful currency unions. A central bank that can comprehensively stand behind the currency and the financial system. The deepest possible economic integration with the flexibility to deal with economic shocks. And a system of fiscal transfers and collective debt issuance that can deal with the tensions and the imbalances between different countries and regions within the union. Currently, it's not that the Eurozone doesn't have all of these, it's that it doesn't really have any of these. Britain is part of the European Union, not by default, but by choice. It fundamentally reflects our national interest to be part of the single market which is on our doorstep, and we have no intention of walking away from it. So let me be clear, we want Europe to be a success. And all the measures that we'll be proposing for next week's European Council can help achieve that success.
Okay, that was David Cameron speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this week, a couple of days ago. Polly, what do you think of what he had to say?
Not very much, to be honest. I'm not quite sure why these leaders and these powerful people aren't, they are recognising the problem, but why not then, in the face of that, coming up with something a bit more substantial? You know, it feels like the same old rhetoric, the same kind of tinkering with the existing system, rather than looking at kind of like a root and branch reform of how our economy is organised and how our financial system works. You know, I mean, if I were him, I think I'd be talking to other leaders about seriously considering a massive debt write-off. And, you know, kind of like one question I always ask myself is like, who do we actually owe this money to? So the debt's increasing and the Treasury keeps on selling more and more of our bonds. And then who's buying them? And I think a large percentage of them are being bought by other central banks. So you've got this situation where all these different countries' central banks are buying each other's debt. And, you know, with the European Union, I mean, like the EFSF is the European Financial Stability Forum, and that is guaranteed by all the member states. So if anyone defaults, they have to pay it. But then at the same time, they are the debtors. So they're both guarantors and debtors. And I mean, we're in this crazy situation where we're literally buying our own debt. And that's kind of what I was talking about before, in terms of these numbers are designed to kind of scare us and to create the acquiescence necessary so that they can push through the cuts agenda.
Okay, but ultimately, I mean, if we were to say, and it sounds a great idea, let's write the debt off, you know, then we don't have to deal with it anymore. But wouldn't that really scare the markets? I mean, ultimately, the bond markets would go ballistic, wouldn't they, if we were to say, oh, by the way, all that debt, we're just forgetting about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the market, and you read a lot about it in the papers, and it's talked about a lot in the media. I saw a headline the other day in the Financial Times saying, meddle with the markets at your peril. And really, you know, what are the markets? And you say, you know, the bond markets would go ballistic. But I think the bond markets, like the interest rate rises and falls, to do with credit default swaps, which were only invented in the last decade by JP Morgan, you know. And so there's kind of like all these imaginary numbers. Oh, they're going up, they're going down. And really, it doesn't reflect anything that's happening in reality.
Glynis, what are your thoughts then?
Well, it sounds to me like we're being governed by, you know, a few people pushing buttons on a computer with magic numbers or something. It's it's quite worrying how we're told we're, you know, worry about the markets, you know, worry about your credit rating. So who is controlling who here? And I think we do need a big review of all of this. And maybe this sort of recession does give the necessary shock to start looking at it all again and challenging a lot of things that have been taken for granted. And, you know, it's almost like living in fairyland.
Polly, is it true to say that actually some of these deals that the markets do, you know, as the markets react to things, are actually computers rather than human beings making decisions?
Oh, yeah. I think it's like, I can't even remember the exact statistic. I think it was 87% of all the shares currently traded on the New York Stock Exchange are done through high frequency trading, which is literally computers that run on these algorithms. So, I mean, it's just, you know, nonsense. You can see the Dow Jones or the FTSE kind of drop by however many percent in a day, but that is literally the result of computers. You know, I don't think there's actually any real people in the London Stock Exchange. It's huge. It's kind of computers. It's almost like this virtual world, but then this virtual world has a real impact on reality because we give it, we treat it as if it were real and as if it were important, and we adjust our decisions according to this sort of imaginary numbers.
Well, you know, it affects our pension funds and.
Yeah, carry on.
Sorry, it's affecting our pension funds because, you know, that's linked into investment and all of that. And
it sounds like we're being run by computers. It's quite scary, isn't it? These computers controlling our entire financial system. Well, I'm sure there are a few computer programmers and bank bosses in there somewhere making a few decisions. But it almost could run away, couldn't it?
Yes, yes.
Anyway, we're joined by Marina Royce now to talk about one of the actual results of all this, which is the benefit caps. I mean, it's all very well talking about the financial system and what it's doing with the money, but the end result is that last weekend the bishops in the House of Lords blocked the government plans to cut child benefit. Bishops helped defeat the government in a key battle over plans to put a ceiling on out-of-work payments. Their call to exempt child benefit from a £26,000 annual cap was backed by Labour peers by a majority of 15 in the House of Lords. Marina.
Hello. The government is proposing to introduce £26,000 per year cap from 2014 on the total amount of benefits that most working age families in the UK can receive. For childless single people, the cap will be £18,200. Ministers claim these cuts will deliver £51 million in benefit saving in the 3 years period to 2015. These savings at less than a quarter of a 1% of the annual cost appears rather low, and if this number is correct, this proposal is more of a political gesture to restrain future growth. Government estimates that the change will affect 67,000 householders in 2013-14 and 75,000 householders in 2014-15, contains 90,000 adults and 220,000 children. The impact will be greatest on larger families living in higher-end areas, such as the southeast. The Children's Society believes that 80,000 children will be made homeless as the families are forced to move out of private sector rented homes that are no longer affordable. According to the DWP's resources accounts, the cost of housing and council tax benefits has been growing rapidly. In 2005-06, the cost was £12.1 billion and £20.5 billion in 2010-11. These costs have increased by nearly 70% during this 5 years period. Over the same period, the inflation index used by government for capital gains tax on property has increased properly taxable values by about 70.5%. This would imply that rents are increasing far faster than inflation, or the mix of properties in which claims lives has changed, or more families have come to depend on these benefits, or most probably some combination of these conditions. What do you Bristolians think of these proposals? The government wants to cap total family benefits at £500 per week. Is this punishing the weakest in society or a move towards a fairer society?
It's a move by them to take more money away from people who are struggling and therefore spend less money and privatise the NHS and everything else. It's all part of an overarching agenda. It's not as straightforward as just punishing people. It's the fact that those people don't matter to the government just now.
A move towards a fairer society, because there's a big disbalance in terms of our benefit system and people who work and pay taxes.
I think it's a bit of both, and, you know, different situations call for different tactics. I guess in some way it is, but in other ways it's reducing housing benefits, forcing more people to get jobs, which means they don't have to be on benefits in the first place.
It's not a punishment at all. I personally, that's what I think.
Does society have an obligation to provide housing for all, irrespective of cost? And does a benefit culture work?
Because it's a basic human right. Housing, safe housing, not being forced to sleep rough or live as we did 200 years ago, should be a basic human right. I personally believe that. There are other countries where people can't do that and they'd like to, and we can provide it. It's easily within our means. The benefit culture has been of a massive boost to the vast majority of society, but there are some people who've become trapped within it, just as previously there were people who would be depending on their local church parish for survival. Some people have managed to slip through the cracks, but at the same time, the majority of us would love to be in work, and the only thing preventing us from being sleeping rough on the street is the fact that there's a little bit of backup paid for by ourselves and our parents in the past.
There's an obligation to provide housing for people who need it. It should, but it doesn't work as well as it could, because we kind of created this culture of handouts. In doing so, created a culture of people who don't feel they need to work, and that's wrong.
Yes, there is an obligation to provide housing, and it is wrong to depend on state handouts. But, well, the whole benefit culture, obviously, is being abused, and we know that. The right steps need to be taken to address the main culprits of abusing the system.
If you can get a job, it is, you should go and afford it, but it's wrong to live on benefits just because you can live.
People need to work. They need to know from the beginning to push people to do whatever they want to do to survive, not to expecting other people to work hard and give them money to survive.
Is the problem of the high cost of housing for poorer families the result of the policy to sell council houses? And what needs to change?
The previous policy of selling council houses has had something of a long-term knock-on effect, but it's tied in with the fact that the baby boomer generation had a vast amount more money, their houses were cheaper, and now houses are assets as opposed to just homes. People need to separate housing and money, because housing should be a human right, whereas making a profit is a good thing and a positive thing and boosts the economy and makes some people's lives better, but if it's at the cost of other people's human rights, then it's not a good idea. The fact of the matter is, right now, there's vast amount of brownfield sites, enough to build on for the next 4 years and build affordable housing. But private developers won't do that, because why should they risk their profits? There's no incentive whatsoever for them to build affordable housing and make people's lives easier. There's no point. They can just hang on another 10 years and then make more money off it then. And keeping house prices high is great for people who own the land and own the houses and own the buildings. It just makes life difficult for everybody else, and we maybe need to move the emphasis as a society towards looking after everybody in a very basic way, possibly taking a little bit of the emphasis away from keeping rich people rich.
More houses, I guess. There isn't really a perfect answer.
Build more cheap houses, but whether that's a short-term benefit or a long-term benefit, you don't really know.
Well, that was you talking about what you think of the £26,000 a year benefit cap that the government wants to introduce. Lib Dem councillor Glenys Morgan, what are your thoughts about what you've just heard? And are you in favour of this
£26,000 cap? It's, as with many of these things, I think it's not so straightforward. I think that people make good points about homelessness, and certainly we want to. That is not what people want. I've heard one thing that interests me. I heard recently that homelessness is there are different definitions of it, and that it can mean that children have to have a bedroom each, which is not what most of us think of as homelessness. You know, out in the street was quoted there and said in the piece. I think there is no intention of the government that anyone would be out on the street, and that will not happen. But
I think, to be fair, I mean, is there are different degrees of homelessness, and most of the official ways of registering the numbers of homeless would include, say, for example, a family that's having to live in less than, I mean, not if each child doesn't have to have their own room, but if, say, for example, parents and children are having to live in the same room, or else if someone is living in a house, they're not actually outside the house, but they're living on a sofa in someone's front room, then they're classed as homeless, if they're inadequately housed in some way. But I mean, some of the figures are pretty shocking. I mean, we're talking about saving £51 million, but this affecting 67,000 households, and most importantly, 80,000 children being made homeless because of this.
Yes, well, that's what I would challenge possibly. Is this 80,000? Does that mean people within their...
Well, having to move, basically, because private landlords that they're living with would... paying the rent to those private landlords would take them over the 26,000.
I think the key to this is that we don't want people who are actually working to be worse off than those who are, you know, who are receiving benefits. And that's where... That's why the introduction of a cap, which is what the average family is supposed to be able to earn. And I do think it's good that it's been challenged in the Lords, and that because there are so many sweeping reforms going on at the moment, with that, I think, you know, the devil's in the detail, and they do need to be examined much, much more closely. So I do welcome the fact that it has been challenged and it will go back. And I think the government has, you know, reasons for excluding child benefit. London is, you know, high prices of housing. That is a really key thing in this as well. And I don't think it does anybody any good, apart from possibly lawyers and estate agents who benefit when houses are bought and sold. But again, I come back to, you know, working people are in. They have to move. They have to move their children out of schools if they can't afford to be. If their salary goes down. So I don't think we can protect our people on benefits from some of the impacts of what's happening here.
But why should 80,000 children be made to be forced to move or possibly be made homeless because of the mistakes of the bankers?
Well, I think I wouldn't accept that 80,000 children will be made homeless in the sense that most.
Well, according to the Children's Society.
I don't think, and I think there will be transitional arrangements if there was a situation where people had to move out of where they currently are. But equally, you know, I think it is a question of fairness, and that's fairness to people who make the effort to. It's not just making the effort, it's having the jobs there. That's the other complication.
The other thing, of course, is that people's salaries have not been increasing. This is one of the problems that's causing this, really, is that the low paid are getting even lower and lower paid, and they're being driven down below the poverty levels because of the benefits are set at the poverty level.
Yes, and one thing the government's trying to do about that, and Lib Dem move, is to move the level of the point at which you get tax relief to up to 10,000, and to, you know, you've heard this week that Nick Clegg is trying to get that brought forward rather than wait till 2015. That's one way of addressing that issue. But I don't. One of the things I would definitely like to see is closing this gap, which was increasing over the years under Labour as well as under Conservative governments. And I would like to see much more emphasis on dealing with those people at the top, the wealthy people who can afford to avoid taxes and pay for ways of managing that money abroad.
Some people that seem to be doing quite well out of this are the landlords. Apparently costs going from housing benefit that are going to these wealthy landlords, private landlords, have gone up over 5 years around about 70%. So they're not really playing their part in dealing with the recession and taking any hit at all, are they? They really may be taking advantage of the fact that there's such a high demand for housing.
Yes, and possibly a lot of those are benefiting from the fact that benefits are high, and they know they will be paid and paid reliably. Is how they, you know, they've been paid directly in the past. That's not going to happen in the future, as I understand it. So they're making their money out of this in many respects.
So this will at least one thing from this is that maybe landlords won't be able to just guarantee they're going to be getting their high rents.
Polly, no, they won't.
Polly, this is really the effects of what we were talking about before we heard Marina's piece, which is the rather staggering figure from the Children's Society of 80,000 children in Britain being made homeless by this.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me totally unacceptable, and I don't think people should have to move because of this. And it seems like a pretty good example of what seems to happen a lot, which is that you know, the kind of dominant discourse of the government and mainstream media sets the debate up as, you know, kind of amongst the people. So, you know, like we just heard, people get very angry. We're getting angry at each other rather than really realizing that, you know, perhaps it's not each other's fault. You know, it's perhaps, you know, it's kind of government really. And, you know, it says like 51 million will be saved, but then you've got, you know, corporations getting away with billions of pounds worth of tax evasion. So Vodafone, for example, £7 billion in unpaid tax. And then we're talking, you know, about having 80,000 children being made homeless to save 51 million. And I suppose it just raises bigger questions about what kind of society do we want to live in? And, you know, what do we value and what do we want to prioritise?
Well, one of the other things that I've just been flicking up on the computer here on the news is that it turns out that the RBS have been using massive amounts of their bailout money to lobby both here in Britain and over in the United States. So a lot of the money that we've spent on bailing out these banks is actually being used to pressurise governments.
Yes, and I'm very anti that. And particularly when it's our money, I think the lobbying that's done by people who can afford to do it is very damaging. And, you know, these families on benefits aren't able to do that sort of lobbying. And, yeah, I'd sooner see much more going, you know, that sort of money should be going into lending money to people so that they can get mortgages and stimulate the house market again, and getting jobs for people to move into and off benefits. So very much anti the.
But would you accept that the benefits are actually quite a good thing? People are getting large amounts in benefits because that money is then being spent into the economy in one way or another, and it keeps things going. Now, as soon as you start taking that, as soon as you start taking that demand out of the economy, you're getting even less economic activity and less GDP. This is one of the reasons we've been hearing this week that we're going into potentially anyway another double dip recession.
Yes, we are. But I don't think you're almost suggesting giving money away. Benefits for those who need them, yes, and we must make sure that those who need them have them. But if the level is set too high, then it almost becomes an aspiration to, and we know that for some people, to you know, to go onto those benefits, and then a culture develops where people are, that's their way of life, and they can't break out of that. So let's encourage more people into jobs, apprenticeships, all the rest of it, work experience, whatever, voluntary sector. Protect those who need it, but use the money, any money that we've got, to stimulate the economy else in other ways.
Okay, Polly, what about lobbying? Because we heard before Christmas from David Cameron that he is going to be dealing with the lobbyists. I mean, we had a bit of a scandal, didn't we, with Bell Pottinger, who were boasting that they could fix up meetings between the Prime Minister and the Ambassador of China. And this is one of these big strategic communications firms that are actually quite shadowy organisations, difficult to find out much about them. And yet they seem to be the fixers behind the scenes. They're certainly doing a lot of lobbying. So have we heard anything yet from Mr. Cameron about what he's going to do about lobbying? He's promised that he would have something by the end of January. We're nearly there, aren't we?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, he's not doing an awful lot. I think a few days ago they released some proposals, and I mean, the problem with the proposals is that they only deal with lobbying firms. So lobbying firms, basically there's in-house lobbyists and then lobbying firms. Now, in-house lobbyists work for large corporations, very large charities, trade associations, and basically organisations that are big enough to have the money to pay full-time professional lobbyists. So Tesco, for example, has 5, and it's their permanent job to kind of deal with the government and lobby the government. Now, there's absolutely nothing in the proposals that would deal with those kinds of in-house lobbyists, which are surely really the kind of real issue you're talking about, shadowy, you know, a lot of influence. Now, that's presumably what any kind of regulatory proposals would be designed to prevent. So rather than dealing with that, it doesn't deal with that at all, and instead deals only with lobbying firms who are often employed by much smaller organisations who want to lobby on a specific issue. These are often the smaller organisations that don't have the money and the power that the larger organisations do. And so these proposals actually regulate those smaller organisations generally rather than the larger ones. So it seems to me that, you know, the proposals aren't doing what they're intended to do at all.
I think this is typical of what we hear an awful lot of talking from Mr. Cameron, and but actually when it comes to following it through, there seem to be reasons why something can't be done, and it's forgotten about, and then the next big thing is there for him to shout about, and they slip by. I was really hoping that we were going to get a lot more reforms after MPs' expenses, the lobbying. You know, where is it?
Well, it might be because the boss of one of the biggest lobbying firms in the country lives right opposite David Cameron in his Witney constituency, and maybe he's trotting across the road and they're doing a bit of lobbying over dinner around Mr. Cameron's house. I mean, we also heard just last week that David Cameron's being accused of watering down the lobbying crackdown, which is what you described it as before Christmas. It all seems to have been forgotten now because the new rules are full of loopholes. David Cameron was last night accused of watering down plans of lobbyists. So in what way should Cameron be dealing with this, Polly?
Okay, so at the moment, the proposals, aside from what I was just saying in terms of lobbying firms and in-house lobbyists, they don't tell you what they would require is for these lobbying firms to tell you who is being who is doing the lobbying. Now, they don't tell you what is being lobbied for, so what these people are actually wanting to achieve. You don't even have to say, the area, the policy area that you want to affect or influence. They also don't have anything about the financial information, so you have absolutely no idea how much money is being spent by this person or this firm in trying to achieve their objective. So, I mean, for example, if we knew how much the private healthcare industry was spending on lobbying for the current NHS reforms, that might totally, you know, reshape the entire debate. And so, I mean, if we don't know, if all we know, all we have is a list of who is lobbying, but we don't know what they want and we don't know how much money is being spent on it, then it just seems pretty meaningless, really.
Senior Liberal Democrats, because there's a consultation paper been published by the Cabinet Office on this, were saying that the lobbyists should declare details of how much they're spending and what they're seeking in influence. The plans, proposals anyway, that Mr. Cameron's put out actually rule out any code of conduct for lobbyists and also don't cover those, as Polly was saying, that work directly for companies. So it sounds like a bit of a fudge.
It does, and I think there are too many bits of fudges going on.
I mean, for example, with Bell Pottinger, they actually will refuse to tell you who they're working for at all. I mean, who could they maybe be working for a foreign government? They could be working for a foreign arms manufacturer. Who knows who they could be working for? The Iranian company that's making, enriching uranium, and we wouldn't know.
Well, it makes me think that just crossed my mind that we used to have court circulars and we are told, you know, who's going where in amongst royalty. Maybe we should have a lobbyist circuit when we hear who's lobbying what and how much and when. Yes, I think all that should be transparent out in the open, and I think that's where the government should really be focusing rather than, I mean, I do want it to address the benefit system to some extent, but let's give much more priority to all these all the things that are going on at the other end of the scale.
So Polly, finally on this subject, do you think that somehow we've touched a nerve here, you know, the media, and particularly with the Independent that did this investigation into Bell Pottinger, because it seems like there was a load of fuss at the time, oh yes, we've got to act on this, and now pretty much nothing.
Yeah, well, I think that's why Cameron's been promising that he's going to do something about it. And I mean, in opposition, I have here he's saying, quote, "I believe that it is increasingly clear that lobbying in this country is getting out of control," he said. And now it seems, you know, he's kind of trying to do a little bit, but he's perhaps aware that, you know, if there were that level of transparency, then he might not be able to carry on doing what the government's doing at the moment.
The trouble is, of course, he has to come to the country once every 4 years to ask us what we think. But those lobbyists, they're banging on the door every single day. 5 o'clock in the morning, there they are. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions and see how Ed Miliband got on in his exchange with David Cameron.
Ed Miliband!
Speaker, he says there's not 1 ounce of complacency, but he and his Chancellor are but the byword for self-satisfied, smug complacency. And that is the reality. And he talks about borrowing, Mr. Speaker. He's failing not just on unemployment, not just on growth, but on borrowing as well. Because of his failure on growth and unemployment, he's borrowing £158 billion more than he forecast. And now we know. He said unemployment would fall. It isn't. He said our economy would grow. It hasn't. He said we're all in this together. We're not. When will this Prime Minister face up to the fact it is his policies that are failing our country?
Prime Minister,
our economy grew last year, but he can't find it in himself. There are more people in work today than there were at the time of the last election, but we were given.
The House must calm itself. We'll hear the Prime Minister.
We were given a very clear instruction yesterday at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The Shadow Chancellor said the government should listen to the IMF and change course. At 7 o'clock in the evening, the IMF told us what we should do. They said this: we do not think that fiscal consolidation adds to the problem. Fiscal consolidation is part of resolving the problems facing the UK economy. That is the truth, Mr. Speaker. There are two parties in this country taking responsibility for clearing up the mess. There is one party refusing to take responsibility for causing the mess.
So that was Ed Miliband and David Cameron, a little exchange at Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday in the House of Commons. Lib Dem Councillor Glenys, what were your thoughts about performance of your leader? I mean, you know, your coalition leader there. Do you think he's...
Yes,
I mean, because I wonder...
Leader,
I wonder whether you really feel he's seriously answering questions at places like Question Time, or is there a bit of bluster in there?
Well, I think there's always lots of bluster at Question Time, and I think David Cameron is known to be very good at PR, and that's, we see his high standing in the popularity figures for leaders, way ahead of Ed Miliband, despite the economic situation. So I think he's a very good talker, but on the other hand, Ed Miliband and the Labour Party are going to be suffering for quite a while yet from their reputation. They had the chance to do lots of things in their, while they were in government. I am pretty sure child poverty went up then. The equality, the gap between rich and poor widened. Unemployment was rising then. And, of course, they were doing lots of borrowing, lots of spending as well, as were many of us individuals. So, I think...
Yeah, I mean, when I was on the dole, I mean, with the Co-op Bank, this is a few years ago, I went into the bank one day to pay a £10 check-in, and they said, oh, would you like a £15,000 loan? And I was thinking, well, Absolutely. Hang on, I'm unemployed. I'm only on the dole. Why should I take... Actually, what I did was I said to them, actually, no, I want a sports car. I'd rather have £50,000. So the lady had to go away and find... to see if I could have £50,000 loan, and then she came back and rather shamefacedly said, "I'm sorry, no, you can't have £50,000." But I mean,
but there was a try in those days.
there was an attempt, I think, in, you know, to get people to take out loans that they couldn't pay back.
Yes, absolutely, and it's really done a bad disservice to our children who've suddenly been brought up. Having got into that way of thinking, and now have to completely retreat, and they almost haven't known anything else. At least some of us who are older remember when you did actually have to save to get something. I'm quite interested, actually, if you don't mind, to hear from Polly about. I mean, IMF has so much respect amongst the leaders, Europe, and on the economy. I'm wondering, is that justified? Well, if the IMF says something, or then, you know, we must listen to what they're saying.
Yeah, well, it's curious. I was just thinking when I was listening to him, he said, you know, the IMF told us what we needed to do,
exactly.
And we did it. And it's interesting because who are these people? They're certainly not democratically elected. Mm. And, kind of, it's quite a technocratic, as I understand it, the IMF is quite a technocratic institution. And so if you read IMF reports, what you'll often find is lots of technical language, lots of very detailed and complicated looking graphs. But really, I mean, kind of the way that political economy of the style that I've studied would look at things is that, everything is kind of... It's ideological, or, you know, there are moral and ethical aspects to the economy which institutions like the IMF don't actually recognise. So it's portrayed as, you know, fiscal consolidation is the right thing to do, and that is a fact, you know, that is a truth. Whereas we would say perhaps that's one opinion, and that suits certain interests over others. So I think the issue of the IMF and how much credibility we want to give it, you know, really needs to be kind of thought about, and we need to start questioning, you know, who these technocrats are and what agendas they're serving.
Well, they always go on about GDP, don't they? They want to get our GDP up, growth the whole time. But what's that got to do with quality of life?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's two issues with this whole growth thing. The first one is, you know, if we accept that we live in a world of finite resources, which I think everybody study pretty much does, then why are we running our economy aspiring to constantly grow and produce more? And then the second thing is that also in our GDP figures, we're including financial services. Now, like I've said on the programme before, you know, a lot of this financial stuff is imaginary. So the numbers can escalate and escalate and grow and grow and grow, but that's not really reflecting anything being produced or being made in reality. And, you know, especially in finance, you can have huge profits being made, so they'll add a lot to GDP. It looks like a lot's being produced numerically, but actually that can be done by one computer, so you're not even employing people, and you know, as the GDP is supposedly growing.
So Glenys, do you think we're getting a bit detached from the city? They seem to be also sort of floating off with a whole bunch of computers and figures going round and round and round on those computers. They're not actually making anything, but they're convincing us that they're making loads and loads of money, and but they can't seem to lend.
No, well, I'm beginning to think actually we're too much attached, and what Polly's talking about is seeping into, you know, our politicians and in the government, and what you're saying about morals and transparency and right and reality. Yeah, I think we need to have a really big look at all of this again and see actually where we're going and where we're not going. Okay. If it's even possible to see through. Yeah, we need to look at all of this very carefully again. And I say the recession maybe has given us an opportunity, shocked us into looking at all these things once more.
Okay, we're looking at a local story to begin with, a couple of local stories. So the mayor, it looks like a date has been set for Bristol to decide on an elected mayor. The questions Bristolians will be asked in May's referendum has been set down. Parliamentary committee up in London, not here in Bristol, confirmed the date of the vote, May the 3rd, and also agreed the wording for the question, the answer to which would shape the city's political future. Ballot papers will read as follows. How would you like Bristol to be run? By a leader who's an elected councillor, chosen by a vote of other elected councillors. This is how the council is run now. Or by a mayor who's elected by voters. This would be a change from how the council is run now. So which way would you vote? And do you approve of this whole process? Glenys Morgan, you're a Lib Dem councillor.
Well, at the moment, instinctively, I think I would be anti a mayor elected by voters. And that's because, again, I think so much nowadays is based on the PR of the leader, not the substance, and how they presented on radio, TV, newspaper. And I don't particularly, you know, I slightly distrust that.
Well, you're saying is that we should, as councillors, should decide rather than the voters. Do you think that's because
yes, but
you
the councillors are elected in the first place, and I mean, you get down to PR there if you like. But I'm not, but I haven't fully decided because I'd like to see what powers the mayor would have. And I took the point of actually what Kerry McCarthy said in that she said I won't be standing for mayor because you know, it's a management post and I'm not here to haven't got experience as a manager. That's part of it anyway. So I'm not clear exactly how it would work out. So I'm waiting to hear more, and I think in our party we're hoping to, you know, we want to have a meeting set up soon where we can discuss it amongst all the members and see what generally as a local party we feel about this, because our leader at the moment, Barbara Jank, is saying she is anti that, and you know, lots of people will feel that way. Our Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams has said he is prepared to, you know, he would consider standing. So it's interesting, and I'd also of interest, I think, is the fact that throughout the country, only 19 people, 19 residents responded to a consultation. And, you know, were any of those people who were wanting to stand anyway? So I would hate to think that the whole thing was decided through a lack of interest and only those who are really passionate about having coming forward.
It seems to be something that's sort of come down on us as a sort of rather than something that Bristolians themselves. And just finally, before we ask Polly about this, you obviously know people, individuals in your party better than individual voters. So do you think that's a reason not to do this?
How do you mean?
Well, you know the individuals that may possibly be the mayor, way things are at the moment, much better than individual voters do. Yes. So you can see through the PR and the spin if someone's doing a sort of glitzy "I want to be mayor" campaign.
Yes. But the only person I've heard about is Stephen Williams, who has said that he might consider it, and depending again what you have to do and what powers there are, maybe he might be very suitable, he might not. So I'm reserving my stance.
Okay, Polly, this is something they do in the US, isn't it? They have these elected mayors in the US. But what are your thoughts about ultimately whether this is a good idea or not?
My instinct is the same as Glenys's. I think I would be wary of making such a quick change to being a mayor who is selected directly by voters. Because really, I mean, in order for any democratic process to work, you need to have the information to make an informed decision. Now, I mean, how much time do people have and how much do people really care? Like you were saying, you know, 19 people have written into the consultation about it. I mean, the current situation at the moment is that in order to get a good grasp of what's really going on, you have to trawl the internet, you have to read, you know, several newspapers. In fact, really, to find out what's going on, you need to go directly onto the websites, read the consultation reports. And I mean, people have jobs and lives. Mm. And I mean, as I understand it, like you said, the councillors are elected and we've elected them because we trust them. And therefore, you know, if we want the mayor to be chosen, well, the leader of the council to be chosen by people who can make informed decisions, it seems that they're in the best place to do that, really.
And this is another whole cost that both the council and the government have to bear in you know, in arranging all this and going through the process. So so personally, I'm not sure there's a lot of incentive for doing it in the first place. Somebody must think so, though.
Mm, and I mean, that's interesting, because if only 19 people are doing this, who has an interest in it being changed to this way, you know? And like you were saying about PR and kind of glitzy campaigns and things, I mean, I think that's actually, you know, something that's quite dangerous. People can kind of get swept up in a sort of popular campaign that's led by the media. And perhaps, you know, we might end up electing someone who doesn't really represent our interests, but who has the money and, you know, the power to kind of get that campaign going.
Okay, yeah. Final story this week. Locally, this is relating to the Joe Yates murder last Christmas. Chris Jeffries, who was the former teacher who was accused by many newspapers of actually being the guy that committed this murder wrongly, is saying that actually it was Avon and Somerset Police, but the editor of the Daily Mirror is saying that Avon and Somerset Police behind the scenes were telling newspapers that he'd done it off the record. And actually Avon and Somerset Police are now saying that they're looking into this and are denying it. But I mean, ultimately, do you think this is right for them to be, if they have done this, to be doing this behind the scenes, to be going around to newspapers and saying, sort of tipping the wink to them and saying that he's done it?
Well, if that was done, yeah, I think it is a very dangerous thing. We know how much power the media have, and the effect of that on somebody's personal life, as as we've seen in this case, has been devastating.
Okay, we're going to have to finish there. Thanks very much, this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Henleys, Glenys Morgan. We're back after the news.